Hey, this is a Dark Tangent, organizer of DEF CON. You're about to listen to some speeches from DEF CON 3, held July 4th, 5th, and 6th at the Tropicana Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1995. Now, the Tropicana has since been renovated. This speech and all speeches are copywritten, all rights reserved, the Dark Tangent, and DEF CON Communications. Permission is expressly granted, though, for educational, non-profit use. If you have any more questions about DEF CON, or want to send me some email about the copyright status, please email me at dt@defcon.org, or the website is www.defcon.org. Now, kick back, get ready for some good speeches, and thanks for supporting it.
Can everybody hear me? Do I need this thing? In the back? Right. Is this better? I hate this thing. Well, first of all, welcome. It's kind of crazy. This is my first Hackers Conference. It was kind of fun last night, so. I don't really know how much people know about cryptography, so I'm going to sort of start pretty basic, but quickly run off into odd tangents. Cryptography is a hot topic these days. A lot of people are interested. My book has sold an awful lot of copies. There are lots of products. I get calls, I get email. The PsiDotCrypt mailing list is just getting bigger and either more or less interesting depending on who you ask. It's really getting to be something that everyone cares about. Newspapers are reporting insecurities of computer networks all the time. We're now looking at electronic payment systems over the network and cryptography associated with that. We're looking at ways to deal with secure credit card numbers, secure telephone calls. Companies now are waking up to the fact that people are listening in on their communications, that their data is valuable and people want to get it. More and more people are getting interested in this. More people want to use this cryptography. And that really bodes well for the privacy industry. On the other hand, we have the forces of the U.S. government at work. Anybody from the U.S. government raise their hand? Hi. You guys know who you are. There's a strong push in this country against cryptography and against the widespread use of cryptography. And what I want to talk about is the kind of things we're likely to see in the next 5 to 10 years and how they might affect us and what we can do to sort of nudge them in directions that we think might be better. So it's clear that the future is going to bring more widespread use of cryptography. PGP is a good example of that. Many, many more people have that than use that, but there are a lot of people that use that. And as the user interface gets better, more and more people will use that. The whole Clipper initiative by the U.S. government showed us that while people aren't willing to buy a Clipper phone, there are a lot of people who are interested in secure telephones, and that people would use secure telephones if they were actually secure and reasonably priced. It's more clear we're going to see more digital signatures in use. Even the U.S. Post Office, the people who deliver your mail want to get involved in digital signatures. Now, IRS looking at digital signatures for electronic submission of tax forms. We're going to see that in electronic commerce over computer networks. That's going to be more and more ubiquitous as the years go. Less clear is exactly what all these measures are going to protect against and how they're going to protect against it. Cryptography isn't an on-off switch. It isn't like you use it or you don't. You're secure or you're not. There's better cryptography. There's worse cryptography. There's good cryptography. There's bad cryptography. And sort of the degree of cryptography we're going to see is still very much in doubt. What will protect somebody against a coworker might not protect them against a dedicated hacker or a dedicated someone who really wants to break in. And something that will protect against those sorts of people won't protect against a major government who actually has significantly more resources to do their work. And when I look at the future of cryptography over the next 5-10 years, I kind of see four factors. I see research. I see academic research, both in design of new things and in breaking of old things. I see standards. standards based on things that the researchers design. I see products, hopefully based on the standards. And the fourth thing is I see the legal system. The legal system actually is a very strong driver in all of this, and something most people don't follow or understand. So I want to talk about those four things one after the other. My goal is to talk for about, I don't know, half an hour, 40 minutes, and then open the floor to questions. Hopefully there'll be a lot of them. Okay, research. Now, cryptography is a really odd science because you really can never prove any positive results. You can't take an algorithm, a cryptography algorithm, and say, this is secure, and give it a measure of security. All you can really say is, we don't know how to break it, and all of those smart people over there don't know how to break it either. And that says nothing about what someone will figure out tomorrow, or next week, or next year. Now, cryptography is it's an adversarial science. I make something, and someone else breaks it. He makes something, and then someone else breaks it. And through this back and forth of making and breaking, hopefully we advance the science forward. Hopefully we learn new breaking techniques, making techniques. But still, we can never say with some proof that this is secure. Now, adding into this mix are organizations like the NSA, which have an enormous amount of cryptographic knowledge inside their walls that never leaves their walls. So not only can we not say that this won't be secure tomorrow, we can't even say this is secure against those inside the walls, because they know things that we don't. It's nice. It's a nice one-way filter. They get everything that we do. We get nothing that they do. Now, in the academic world, cryptography is a very much an alive and well and thriving discipline. There are over a dozen academic conferences in cryptography and computer security all over the world, the United States, Europe, Asia, Australia. There was one in South Africa last summer. There are the International Association of Cryptological Research has about 700 members from 45 countries. It's kind of neat to go to a conference where, you know, people who used to be at war are together researching the academic discipline. I think it's kind of a neat thing. Most of the work done at these conferences, though, is very theoretical. It really doesn't apply directly to the everyday craft of making and breaking things, which is what I'm concerned about, which is what people who are going to use this stuff are concerned about. Theoretical underpinnings are very important, but they're not going to help people protect themselves in the next few years. Now, when you look at applied cryptography, the real meat of cryptography today, you see something very interesting. There's an annual workshop on making and breaking algorithms. There's been two of them so far. And if you look at the papers, less than 20% of those papers were written by Americans, by people from the United States. All the rest came from abroad. Now, this is primarily a result of pressure by the NSA through DOE and NSF. It's very hard to get academic funding in this country for applied cryptography, for algorithm work. Now, there are exceptions, it has been done, but mostly the cryptographers in this country do theoretical work. Most of the world's best academic code makers and code breakers come from Europe and Asia, countries like Switzerland, countries like Belgium, Denmark, Israel, Japan, Austria. These countries seem to foster more research in the making and breaking of codes. There are a few companies in the United States where real applied cryptography is done. But again, it's very few. Now, unfortunately, we have all this work done internationally, and the nice thing about international is it doesn't matter. You know, we get to learn it just as much as the people from Switzerland or Austria do, is that it's very diffuse. There's a lot of algorithms and protocols out there, and the research is working on, you know, some on each of them. I mean, 10 years ago, we just had DES. As a little sideline, DES is a data encryption standard, which is sort of the American workhorse of cryptography. I'll talk a little bit more about it later. Now, but 10 years ago, everybody who studied algorithms studied DES, because that was the thing you tried to break. Right? Sort of, you break DES, you get a PhD. So it was sort of a neat little thing. Now there are dozens of algorithms. You know, my book lists about a dozen. I'm doing a second edition now where there's a dozen more. There are lots and lots of algorithms. And the cryptographers are, you know, the work is done spread out among them all. If you remember the way to talk about an algorithm being secure, you had to say, you know, all these smart people couldn't break it, and they spent days, months, years trying. Well, if everybody's trying to break DES, we can make a very strong statement about it. But if there are 20 algorithms, and everybody's working a little bit on each, we can really can only make weaker statements about their security because they haven't had the analysis, the time, the density of analysis. So that's sort of a problem. And the fear is, as more and more people invent algorithms, I mean, algorithms are easy to invent. It's hard to break them. Each algorithm will get less and less analysis, and then we'll be less and less sure about their security, which is a problem, and is a problem because of the next influence, and that's standards. Standards are extremely important in cryptography, especially in network cryptography. It's like a telephone. One telephone on the planet is useless. Right, two telephones are only slightly better. The reason telephones work is because everybody has one. The reason the internet works is we can all access it. If we're going to have a cryptography program which we can talk to each other securely, we all need to have it. So we all need to be writing to the same standard. So DES has been the standard for cryptography for 19 years. I guess coming on 20. And it's long time to replace it. I assume people here have heard about the brute force cracking engines that can theoretically break DES in 3.5 hours for $1 million. Right. The question is always, has anybody built this machine? My feeling is the US government would be derelict in its duty if it didn't. I mean, you assume that major governments have these machines. Hopefully they're busier and more important people than you and me. But certainly DES is reaching the end of its useful life. You know, it's a very good algorithm, it's beautifully designed, it's very secure, but its key length is just too small for today's security needs. And so why has DES been around for 20 years? We've trusted it because the NSA had a hand in its design. But you laugh, but that's really kind of neat. Because for 20 years, we had something. Now, the NSA is this big black box where nothing ever comes out. And hey, something came out. Something the NSA said is secure. Well, either one of two things. One, we can prove them wrong and look really important. Or two, we can figure out why they're right. Which, although less sexy, is even a better thing. And that's what we've been doing for 20 years. For 20 years, academic cryptography has gone to school on DES. You know, in 1991, two Israeli cryptographers had a major breakthrough in cryptanalysis based on studying DES. And this is something that the NSA knew about 20 years before. In 93, we learned something else about DES and how it works and how to design algorithms securely. So even as early as a few years ago, we are learning from DES. We're learning why it's secure. And this is also good because as more people study it and learn why it's secure, confidence in it grows. So now we have to replace it. And what's the prognosis for that? Well, there are a bunch of candidates, but none have really taken widespread hold. The most conservative candidate is something called triple DES, which is, it's like three DESs in a row. Trust me on the math. The international banking community, you know, sort of well known for their conservativeness, is looking at triple DES as the new standard. It's nice because it leverages the strength of DES while making it more secure against brute force attack. I mean, triple DES is kind of a neat thing. The NSA is pushing an algorithm called Skipjack, which was the secret algorithm in the Clipper chip. Yeah, this actually is more secure than DES, assuming you buy that it's secure, because it has an 80-bit key. And actually, I would buy that it's secure. I mean, the NSA would look really stupid if they published an algorithm and it was an easy break. We'd lose all confidence in them forever. And my feeling is that they would not promulgate an algorithm they know is insecure. But you know, Skipjack is not really being embraced because it's in a secret chip. Nobody knows how it works. And now, okay, here's hacking project number one. Reverse engineering the Skipjack algorithm out of the Clipper chip. Right? We went to school on DES for 20 years. We'd like something new to go to school on. Skipjack is an algorithm invented in the, I think started design in 87 or 89, and they've worked in it about 6 years internally. So here's something, if it became public, we can start studying. Another thing known to be secure. One presumes that the NSA hasn't put all their new neat ideas in there. It's something called the high-risk algorithm. So they probably expect to be reverse engineered within the next 4 or 5 years. But there's a really good project that would make a lot of people happy. So those are two potential replacements. There's the IDEA algorithm that was developed in Switzerland, and its main claim to fame is its use in PGP. It's gotten a reasonable amount of analysis and looks very good. Unfortunately, it's patented, and there are license requirements for its use, which doesn't thrill me. There's something called RC4, once a trade secret from RSA Data Security Inc. until it was anonymously posted on the net. If anybody here was one who did that, thank you very much. Right, you know, that's also, RSA Data Security Inc. is pushing that as a standard because it's their algorithm. There's another algorithm called, there are a bunch of also-rans. Blowfish is something I wrote, something called SAFER, also out of Switzerland, something called CAST, out of Northern Telecom in Canada. Another RC5, RC2. Yeah, so there are a whole lot of these. And, you know, how do you pick them? Well, as I said, a major issue is key length. All the good alternative algorithms have long keys. Triple DES is 168 bits. IDEA and SAFER are 128 bits. Some algorithms, like RC4 and Blowfish, have variable length keys. Skipjack, with an 80-bit key, is actually fine. That's long enough for today. But in another 20 years or so, it's probably look about as bad as DES. You sort of have to imagine the whole standards process is very slow. Any algorithm proposed today is not going to see widespread use in another 5 years, at least. And then it might be used for about 20 years to protect traffic. And that information it protects might have to remain secret for another 20 years. So really, when you look at an algorithm today, you want it to remain secure for 50 years or more. Now, U.S. Census data, by law, has to remain secret for 100 years. So, while it's absolutely futile to estimate computing power over 50 years, 100 years, right? Anybody who does that is just foolish. I do that, and I'm foolish. You just sort of do the best you can and try to be very, very conservative. Public key cryptography, which is sort of the other half of cryptography, the world's more or less standardized on the RSA algorithm, both for encryption and digital signatures. U.S. government's digital signature algorithm notwithstanding. For many years, the algorithm has not seen very widespread use due to some pretty tyrannous patent policies by RSA Data Security Inc. and public key partners. In the 90s, that's loosened up considerably, mostly because RSA has sort of seen the end of their patent. The RSA patent expires in the year 2000. And more importantly, the El-Gamal patent, which is the base patent of public key cryptography, actually the Diffie-Hellman patent, which covers the El-Gamal algorithm, will expire in 1997. And by then, we'll have public domain public key cryptography that anybody can use and put in products without paying any licensing fees. There's a lot more to standardization than just the algorithm. RSA Data Security Inc. has promulgated a whole set of standards for using RSA. Exactly how messages are packed and how things work. They're sort of nice standards. There are alternative standards, but those seem to be making the most widespread use. Again, key length is important here. Public key algorithms like RSA and El-Gamal can be used with any key length. And unlike algorithms like DES and the secret key algorithms, the brute force attack is based on factoring very, very large numbers. Factoring is a hard problem. It's known as a hard problem. There's actually math there. Ignore that for now. It's the interesting thing about factoring is that while it's hard, and it's known to be very hard, it seems to be getting easier. And according to Arjun Lenstra, he's at Bellcore, he's probably the world's best factor at the moment, it's getting easier faster than anybody expected. The current factoring record is 129 digits, which I believe happened last year. It happened distributed factoring on the net. And that equals about 428 bits. So people have, you know, 512-bit PGP keys. You know, the number's approaching. Most experts believe that 512-bit numbers are factorable today. And if someone throws enough computers at the problem, you know, it can be done today. And to hear the factorers talk, they figure in less than 10 years, 1,024-bit numbers will be factorable. Further in the future, they don't know. They don't even want to guess. The increases of factoring are based on three things, based on actually raw increase in computing power as we get better chips. Factoring is an inherently distributable problem. So as we get more network resources, we can factor. You know, so even if computers don't get better, they just get better linked, we'll be able to do factoring better. And the third thing is increases in the mathematics of factoring. There's no theoretical limit to how fast factoring can get. And we seem to be creeping up slowly. So, you know, so those three things make factoring easier. So again, it pays to be extremely conservative. Other part of standards are protocols, which are actually even harder to protect than algorithms. What do we have out there? We have Kerberos, which is widely used with varying degrees of success because it's implemented with varying degrees of correctness. There are lots of alternatives in the academic literature. None have seen anything close to widespread deployment. For email, we have PGP and PEM. PEM has the benefit of being an internet standard, but on the other hand, nobody uses it. PGP has the benefit of lots of people use it, but it's not a standard. Both of these are first-generation email security standards, protocols. It is likely something will come to replace them. What will it look like? I have no idea. Now, it's extremely hard to make predictions with no data. So the third thing I want to talk about is products, because, you know, all the research in the world doesn't protect a single bit of traffic. In order to protect privacy, we need actual products. Cryptography has to find its way into the marketplace, has to be bought, and has to be used. That's the only way it'll be effective. I mean, the whole point of me writing Applied Cryptography was to take 20 years of academic research and make it understandable by, like, normal people, by programmers, by techies. Make them intelligent consumers, make them intelligent producers. We want to make this research accessible to technologists, to programmers, to engineers. And we want people to turn that research into products. Now, there are a lot of obstacles to this. NSA, back again. Before the 1980s, their strategy in cryptography was to classify everything, which actually worked pretty well. When the IBM invented the DES, all of the, the research discoveries they made were classified. That's why we didn't know about differential cryptanalysis until the mid-90s. In the 80s, their strategy shifted from blocking research to blocking products. Now, they have no direct control of American companies, but through the Department of State, they have control over export laws. And they've exercised that control in an extremely draconian manner. Anything except, toy cryptography is barred from export. So U.S. companies can either choose to deliberately cripple their products, or they can choose to forego the entire international marketplace. Now, that's a hard choice, because cryptography is international. The Software Publishers Association, the SPA, is doing a study on international cryptography, and they found over 400 foreign commercial cryptography products, many of them using DES, which is prohibited from export from the U.S. They found secure telephones, secure modems, secure fax machines, software products for any number of platforms and applications. Now, there's no rules barring the import of cryptography into the United States, only the export. So the products are actually there for those who want. And there are many stories of U.S. companies buying foreign products rather than buy, crippled U.S. products. The main problem with these standalone products is that they're expensive, and they're kind of irritating to use. Yeah, and this is This is inherently a problem for everybody, because as long as cryptography is old, used only by those who need it enough to spend the effort and money, it'll remain a red flag in networks. In a network of unprotected email, a single encrypted message is immediately suspicious. And don't think that there aren't entities that log who encrypted mail goes from and to. That's called traffic analysis. It's extremely important intelligence information. You know, if someone has an encrypted disk drive, or they make an encrypted telephone call, then you know they're obviously flagged as something. Someone has something to hide. For cryptography to be truly successful in the world, it has to be ubiquitous. I have to protect, be able to protect both the important and the trivial. That way, we have a network full of encrypted messages. Most of them are boring. You know, everything's encrypted. It's the analogy, if everybody sent postcards, one letter in an envelope is suspicious. If everyone says that sends letters in envelopes, then nobody thinks twice about it. And you know, for this to happen, cryptography has to be as easy as opening a dialog box on your computer, clicking a button, and going. It has to be as easy as you know, pushing a button on your telephone that says go secure. Or having it happen anyway, automatically, when you make a phone call. It has to happen all the time. And export controls, they actually prevent cryptography from becoming ubiquitous. You know, Microsoft makes about 60% of its money abroad. It cannot afford to have a U.S.-only product and a product for export. They have to have one code base. If there were no export controls on cryptography, it would be just as much a part of Windows as compression is. It would just be there. It would be just another utility. Everybody would have it. Everybody would use it. It would be automatic in communications programs. It would be automatic in your spreadsheets and your word processors. It would be automatic in everything because it's a nice feature. You can give it to someone cheaply and easily, and they can use it. It's value added. But as soon as export controls come in, suddenly you have to be concerned about, can you export this version or that version? You have to have two versions of the code, two builds, two separate warehouses. Right? If you accidentally export the product, you're an international arms smuggler and you go to Leavenworth. Right? It's just not worth it to most companies. It's not longer a value add, it's a cost for them to have to deal with this. So when you think about export controls, and many people criticize them for making no sense, because they don't really stop the flow of cryptography across our borders, you have to remember that was never really their intention. Their intention is to prevent the widespread use of cryptography. And for that, they're succeeding very, very well. The NSA has also spent effort trying to block strong cryptography in standards committees. They have tried to block the use of triple DES by the banking industry. It looks like they will be unsuccessful, but they have sort of an amusing letter which they sent to the committee explaining why triple DES is a bad idea. I mean, clearly nobody in the cryptography office of the NSA wrote it. They've successfully foisted an all but useless cryptography standard on the U.S. digital cellular industry, CDPD, I think, cellular packet, digital, whatever. There's an all but useless cryptography standard being used for European cellular. There's pressure against Microsoft. Microsoft is thinking about doing a cryptographic API. There's pressure on Microsoft to make that the way the NSA wants. There's a lot of, I get a lot of anecdotal evidence of NSA people visiting U.S. cryptography manufacturers, you know, asking nicely for them to crock things. And you know, via the FBI, they're lobbying for key escrow and you know other such devices, and a clipper chip being the first example of that. That the NSA is behind Clipper is you know not a public thing. My feeling, you know, looking at Clipper, looking at the finances of Clipper, it makes very little financial sense for the FBI to be backing it the way it is. It just costs too much money. And my feeling is that the NSA is driving escrow encryption on the Clipper chip. And if you look at the Clipper chip, even though it sort of died, it turned out to be a big win for the NSA. And to see it, you have to look at a little bit of the history. AT&T was going to market a secure telephone with DES encryption. And they made some, and they started marketing it. NSA got wind of it and said, oh my God, this is horrible. They went to AT&T and said, look, we will give you this chip called the Clipper chip. It is a drop-in replacement to the DES chip you're already using. No redesign is required. We will pay for your development cost. We will buy the first, I think, like 9,000 telephones off your assembly line if you use this Clipper phone instead. And AT&T said yes, because the finances look good. Right? U.S. public might have rejected Clipper, but we still can't buy that DES telephone. So NSA secured themselves a victory there. Now, NSA's mission is really aided by what I see as a very naive consumer base. You know, many surveys show that people want security, and that actually sometimes even willing to pay for it. There's really no way to separate facts from hype, right? The problem with bad security is it looks exactly the same as good security. There's no good housekeeping seal of approval on security products. Nobody certifies that this is actually secure. And if you read product literature, there's a lot of hype. There's a lot of claims being made that just don't make sense. And as long as there's no body looking at products and seeing if they're secure, manufacturers will continue to make unsubstantiated claims about security, and consumers will continue to believe them, and bad products will continue to get out there. Right? This is actually a very difficult problem. It's really hard to do security good. You think of security as a chain. Cryptography is a link, key management's a link, physical security is a link. Any break in that chain breaks it. The cryptographer, the people designing the products, have to make everything correct. If you're trying to break it, you have to find one flaw. So it's much harder to design it well. You know, the designer has to choose the algorithm correctly, choose the protocol correctly, design key management, make sure the data is erased properly when it's no longer needed, and just a gob of other things. Right? It's a lot easier in theory than it is in practice. Which is hard for me because I'm mainly a theoretician. Right? The main joke that is, in theory and practice are the same thing, but in practice they're very different. Right? And I see that in products I look at, where they got a lot of things right and messed up this one thing. So that really also plays into the hands of the NSA. And if you Robert Morris, Sr., the work for NSA, now 10 B's up in New England somewhere, once talked in the UK at a protocols workshop, and sort of said, pretty much with glee, that you know the neat thing about cryptography in the real world is you almost never have to break cryptography. People just get it wrong so many other places. And as soon as you deal with people, it's even worse. Right? The Walkers worked for the U.S. Navy. They sold keys to the... It didn't matter how good the NSA boxes were, the keys were sold to the Russians. Right? U.S. Marine Guards in Moscow were seduced. The CIA director for counterintelligence went for $1.5 million, wife included. That's amazingly cheap. Right? People are easy to buy. People are easy to bribe. People are easy to threaten, to coerce. Right? Equipment's a pain, but as long as you're dealing with people, there are always ways to break in. Which is sort of the problem with cryptography. I mean, if cryptography has a problem, it's that it can very easily be measured, and people tend to focus on it rather than the other things. Right? It doesn't matter how good the cryptography is on my hard drive. If the people who are out to listen to my traffic or read my files have a receiver out in my backyard and are reading what's on my screen. Right? I'm not at home now. I don't know who's breaking into my house and installing who knows what on my machine. Right? There are a lot easier ways to break into somebody than through the cryptography. But if you're a major government, you put fences up, you hire guards, right? you protect against all of those things. You have security perimeters. Normal people can't do that. Right? There are many ways in, and I think you guys all should know that more than anybody, any other audience I've spoken to. Okay, the fourth thing I want to talk about is is the legal system. Because right now we're seeing things which are going to affect how cryptography is used in the next few years. We're seeing the states actually producing digital signature acts. Utah has the Utah Digital Signature Act. California, Washington, Colorado, a bunch of states are following. The American Bar Association is producing model legislation for state digital signature acts. These will give digital signatures legal force, so people can actually use them for commerce, use them for contracts. We're seeing laws on privacy. Courts are deciding whether people can be compelled to release their keys if subpoenaed, or whether that's covered under the Fifth Amendment. All these things will be decided in the next few years as things become more and more used, as we get court cases with where cryptography plays a part. We're also seeing people looking at liability in light of cryptography. If you think about cryptography for electronic commerce, it doesn't have to protect the security. It just has to limit the risk. As far as most companies are concerned, a secure computer is a computer that's insured. Because to them, that's what security is. Security means limiting the liability, limiting the risk. So whether it's really secure or whether I could convince an insurance company that it's secure, for a lot of applications, that's the same thing. And we're going to see legal precedents in that area. Right? We're going to start seeing the first electronic filing of tax returns with digital signatures in the next 4 or 5 years. IRS shows up at all the business cryptography conferences, sitting taking notes. I hope they're learning something. So taking all this, looking at the big picture, we can see that as an academic discipline, cryptography has a really bright future. A lot of people are studying it. It's a really sexy discipline. It's fun. You get to break other people's stuff and go up at a conference and tell everybody you did. It's really kind of neat. Right? We're getting more scientists. We're getting more research. We're getting more results. We're getting actually too many conferences. Now, as a consumer product, cryptography has a more fuzzy future. We have a myriad of algorithms of dubious quality. We have competing standards. We have products of questionable security. We're going to see cryptography in products, but it's hard to tell what we're going to see and how good it's going to be. Right? The NSA wants the world to be secure from everybody except the NSA. And they're exerting considerable pressure to make that a reality. And they're doing a really good job. They're convincing people. Right. Certainly digital signatures will become prevalent on the net. Right. NSA likes digital signatures. They can prove that you wrote something and it wasn't spoofed. Right. That gives them better data. I think in the U.S. we're likely to see the prevalence of weak exportable cryptography and some non-exportable strong cryptography. I don't expect export law to change anytime soon. If anybody followed the Cantwell bill of 2 years ago, Maria Cantwell, a Democrat from Microsoft, sponsored a bill to make software encryption exportable, put it on the same jurisdiction as any other consumer product, like whole wheat or toast. And that bill was defeated in the foreign intelligence. There was a closed-door, classified session of the Armed Services, I think Intelligence Committee, where the NSA spoke. And that committee voted unanimously to defeat that bill. That bill never left committee. Which means whatever story the NSA is telling, it sounds really good. The Senate isn't unanimous about anything. So they're telling a really good story. And people shouldn't expect this to change anytime soon. And my feeling that ubiquitous strong cryptography on computers is going to wait until some company outside the U.S. figures out how to integrate it into the software products we use all the time. And I see that coming, because with APIs, companies are working towards extensible software products. So hopefully in the next bunch of years, we're likely to see that. So what can we do about it? What can we sitting here do to make to help tweak this vision into better places. I mean, the first thing we could do is to make people aware of the difference between strong security and weak security. And the way we do that is we break things. Right? This shouldn't be a subversive idea. Let's take airplane safety. Another very important discipline in the world. When an airplane crashes, everybody knows about it. It makes the newspapers. Teams of experts go to the crash site, study every aspect of it, take the plane apart, figure out why it broke, and we incorporate the problems that led to that failure into our next design. That's a really nice cycle. We don't really have that in computer security. When there's a major hack in somebody's network, it's usually hushed up. If information is released, very little is released. We're not able to study the break-ins to the same extent we're able to study airplane crashes. And that denies us, in the business of designing good cryptography and good security, a whole wealth of knowledge. And my feeling is we really need to make break-ins more public. Right? It has to be a big deal. If President Clinton's Social Security number gets posted on the net, there will be repercussions. Right? If computer data from sensitive, going into congressmen is always good because they actually pass the laws. I don't know, and if anybody remembers when I was living in D.C. at the time, so I know the City Paper, which is the D.C. free weekly, went to the video rental store where Judge Bork rented his videotapes and got a list of what he rented, right? We really hoping to find teenage sex sluts, but we found a bunch of dull Westerns. But all of those congressmen who actually do rent teenage sex sluts said, oh my God, this is horrible, and within a month passed a law making it illegal to disclose information about someone's videotape rentals. Right, that worked really well. So we need more of that sort of thing. Right, there are people on cyberpunks who are now trying to actually break working RC4 traffic. That's good. That'll make the papers. All the companies who use RC4 will say, uh-oh, and hopefully they'll think about changing. This kind of stuff increases awareness. Right, Dan Farmer releasing Satan. Really neat. Now, if we don't do that, nobody knows the difference between what's good and what's bad. And we really need to educate people. We also need, people want to go on the making side, we need good products. We need free software. Right? Free software leaks outside the U.S. borders. Don't worry about it. You don't have to do it. I recommend not doing it. It'll happen. Right. I sell a source code disk. I never sent a copy to a non-U.S. citizen outside the U.S. It's available on the FTP site in Italy. I don't know how it got there. Actually, I have no idea how it got there, but it got there. And if there are going to be APIs in spreadsheets and databases and word processors, let's write shareware encryption modules for them. Let's make it easy for people to use cryptography. Let's make it a default. Because that's really what we want. And I suppose that's my pitch. I mean, this is a good audience. I'd like this audience to go out and try to do things to make this world better for personal privacy. I mean, you guys might find that irritating because you can't irritate other people's privacy, but actually it's better. You really do like it, trust me. Right, the government's bigger than you. Cryptography is a great equalizer in the world. It makes my stuff just as secure as the government stuff. So, I'll take questions. Yes. The question is, what are the odds of some kind of government-mandated key escrow? This is actually really interesting, because if you hear Louis Freeh talk, almost every operator, Louis Freeh is the director of the FBI. He's a really evil guy. He actually is. He talks about banning non-escrowed encryption, banning secure cryptography. I don't know. A year ago, I would say, don't be ridiculous. The public would never stand for it. But then, I saw digital telephony ram through Congress. And I never thought that would happen. I mean, we killed it dead, and it came back, and it went through. In the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing, we've seen a rash of really stupid legislation. The Omnibus Counterterrorism Bill is bad news. You know, we have Barbara I think Feinstein did this, proposed a bill making it illegal to write, to post information on how to build a bomb. I mean, you know, I think by the government would be illegal. I mean, don't these people study constitutional law at all? I mean, this is scary stuff. We live in very reactionary times. And the moral in the last few years of legislation is anything can happen in the wake of people getting scared. So, you know, it's certainly possible. I don't think it's enforceable at all. But it's possible. The question is about France, which actually does have more draconian cryptography laws than you do. They have laws on the use of cryptography. You have to, if required, leave a copy of the key with the police department. I have trouble commenting on France because it really is a different mentality. That seems to work for France. But you don't hear about the French being up in arms about this. That seems to work for that country. There are other countries that have not laws against cryptography, but practices against cryptography. Countries like Korea, Taiwan, Singapore. There are no laws that say you can't use cryptography, but if you do and you're noticed, you're politely asked either not to or to give the government a copy of the keys. But that's never actually written down anywhere. I don't know. I mean, the net is too global for national laws like that to survive very long because it's so easy to subvert. I actually agree with that, and that's why the NSA's tactics are working so well, because the USA is so big in software and such a force. And yeah, I agree. Right, you know, I think medical data is another very important area that needs to be protected. A lot of medical information is going online these days. All the big insurance companies have that stuff online. And that's very important for personal privacy. Who has AIDS in this country? You know, let's see a list of congressmen who are HIV positive. That would be fun. You know, right, this kind of stuff that shouldn't get out. But there are actually no laws preventing it. This seems like a big mistake. And then, you know, we not only need the laws, we need the measures. Because it's one thing for the Congress to say, you know, it's illegal to release this information. But it's yet another thing to say that you as a provider are required to protect this information. Right? Canada actually has a bureaucracy for personal privacy. If you are a company and you're designing a database, you have to have the privacy advocate for the province you live in look at what you're doing. And they have to okay that you are safeguarding the privacy of the people whose data you're collecting. I like that. You know, England has something similar. The U.S. can do well to have privacy advocates. There's a question over there. Is a question about factoring and whether methods in factoring make the discrete log problem, something that we should use instead. Effectively, they're, you know, at a first pass, they're pretty much the same thing. Advances in one affect the other. So when you look at key length of public key cryptography, It's looking at basically the same key lengths for whether you're using elliptic curve, sorry, whether using a discrete log or a factoring based problem. There really is no difference. I mean, in the noise there's some, but for all intents and purposes, advances in one affect the other. Right, cryptography is a weapon. The question is about steganography, which is sort of the science of hiding information. Right, we have the NSA with big computers sifting through the data, and if they can't find there's a secret message there, so much the better. And there are programs that hide data in the low order bit of graphics images. This is inherently neat stuff. I mean, the cardinal mutations have some problems. They are, you can find their signatures, but that's going to improve. I think steganography is a good thing, and I like to see that. Because, if you look at the NSA's, data collection problem, and you try to think about, put yourselves in their shoes, you have an enormous amount of data flowing around the world. I mean, the net is, it's just obscene. Right. And if I was sending secret messages to somebody, I would not send it in, secret.messages. I'd send it, in alt.dumb.topic. Right? I'd put it someplace stupid where nobody would think of looking. So the NSA has to search through everything. And their collection problem is an extremely difficult one. So anything that makes that harder is going to be better for us. So it's techniques like steganography, which make it harder to find the messages, are good. Right? Even moderate encryption, if everybody uses it, makes the collection problem intractable. You might be able to break a 40-bit key in 10 minutes, but if you got terabytes of data, if you got a break right now because you're going to get terabytes of data tomorrow, you won't be able to look at it all. Steganography isn't my topic, but I like it. I like to see work done on it. Over there. The question is, sure, the U.S. government, this is the FBI, has used sort of the bugaboos of terrorism, drug dealers, and pedophiles to say, why we have to ban cryptography, because these people use it. And yes, of course, these are legitimate concerns. And the question was, how do you address that? And it actually is very important to think about. If we wanted to live in a society that was absolutely safe, there are a lot of things we would do. There are a lot of things we would allow that we don't allow. Torture is a good example. Right? Societies that allow torture have much less crime. Neat. Societies that don't have laws of search and seizure, laws of due process. As a society, we have to balance our desire for personal freedom with our desire for public safety. And there are many decisions, like the ones I've mentioned, and cryptography is just one of them. My feeling on cryptography, looking at that decision, is it really doesn't seem to give criminals that much of an advantage. Certainly we've learned criminals are stupid, right? They go to get their truck rental deposit back after they bombed the World Trade Center, right? McVeigh was leaving Oklahoma City speeding in a car without a license plate and an unregistered gun in the glove compartment. This guy wasn't smart. So giving these people cryptography, I don't think it's going to help them all that much. And if you look at, who in the world needs it, let's look at the Chinese dissidents. It's a good example of a place where, they now have good cryptography from PGP and other sources. Right? Sure, the Chinese government got it too, but the Chinese government has all the cards. Giving them another card is not gonna make any difference. But the Chinese dissidents had nothing. And giving them cryptography gives them something really big. And I think I feel the trade-off is worth it. I think everybody should think about the trade-off and make it for themselves. But my feeling is it's a worthy trade-off. And I think I'm being am I being thrown off the stage here? Oh, they're not paying attention. What? The question is when the law is going to catch up, and I don't know if they ever will. It's going to take a while. When electronic mail is more popular than physical mail, when everybody is using it. You know, we all use email all the time, so we think everybody does, but most people don't. It's still very minor. Am I being thrown off the stage? Yes. Am I being thrown off the stage? Oh, I got the secret hand signal of being thrown off the stage. Let's take one more question of this person over here, and then I'll leave. The question is, how far ahead of academia is the NSA? Is anybody here from the NSA who can answer that? They never do. Well, and a couple things you can look at. Certainly in the 60s and 50s, they were decades ahead. Because in academia, nothing was done. In the mid-70s with DES, it looks like they are about 20 years ahead. They didn't seem to invent public key cryptography before we did. But they're, in applied cryptography, making and breaking of algorithms, they're probably 10 to 15 years ahead. There's a bunch of things they have that we don't. They have unity of purpose. Right, there are a lot of really cool things I would love to see done in cryptanalysis that if I could just convince someone to do, would be great. Right? The guy who runs R&D for NSA can say, you 10 people work on this problem, and they'll do that. So they're very much focused. They have the background of knowledge that we don't. I mean, they're building on knowledge they had. Right? The stuff they did in the mid-70s, we're doing in the early 90s. I mean, they haven't been sleeping for 20 years. So presumably they have new stuff. What do they have? Is it any good? It's really hard to say. I mean, they're not saying. My feeling is 10 to 15 years in the making and breaking of algorithms. In things like protocols and the more esoteric stuff, digital cash and payment systems, probably very little, because I don't think that matters very much to them. That's actually a cool ending point. So thank you. Have a good weekend. I'll be outside.